This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Talking about race and racism is uncomfortable for a lot of people. It can be hard to know where to start and what to say. Our next guest wants to help guide us through the process and says it's really important to have these conversations about race to hopefully make the world a better place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you talk about race with your friends or family members? Did the conversation come up over Thanksgiving, or do you avoid that kind of conversation, especially at a place like the Thanksgiving table? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Celeste Headley is a journalist with lots of years in public radio, by the way, author of the new book, Speaking of Race, Why Everybody Needs to Talk About Racism and How to Do It. Celeste, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, one of the most common approaches to talking about race, I think, is not talking about it. What are some of the reasons people feel uncomfortable even bringing up the topic?
I think the number one thing is a fear. And it's either fear of getting into an argument or fear of making a mistake. I can allay the first one really quickly, which is that very few people with people they know well, like a family member, a friend, or a coworker, it's unlikely you're going to get into an argument. Most people are conflict averse in that way. So we don't find a lot of, through, you know, scientific surveys and things, we don't find a lot of evidence that it's likely you'll get into an argument with somebody that you know. That's not a Twitter argument. That's, you know, a family member.
Well, and there's another kind of conversation we might often have in our culture about race. I disagree with you, and then we yell at each other about it. How yeah. unproductive is that?
I mean, it's completely unproductive. I zero production. It's actually counterproductive. The reason being that if somebody's mind is going to change about something linked to their identity, like race or deeply held beliefs, it's going to happen over time, and it's going to happen incrementally, which means that in order to make progress, what's important is not necessarily just the conversation you're having then, but the future conversations, having more conversations, multiple conversations. So when you start screaming at each other, what you're really doing is blocking progress by making it less likely that that person will be open to another conversation in the future. So it's not just not productive, it's counterproductive.
We're talking to Celeste Headley about her new book, Speaking of Race, Why Everybody Needs to Talk About Racism and How to Do It. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or maybe your questions, the advice you want to get from our guest. That's 800-642-1234. All that said, Celeste, you make a big point of your book is that it's really important for people who disagree, who have different perspectives on race, to talk to each other. Why, before we get into the how, could you tell us why that is so important?
You know, when you're speaking with people who agree with you, all you're doing is entrenching the beliefs you already have and the opinions you already have. And that's not helping anything change. That's how we got where we are right now, is by each side only speaking to people who basically believe the same thing and just getting more and more entrenched in their beliefs. It also creates this idea, this false sense that most people agree with you, right? Since if all the people you talk to agree with you, it gives you this idea that the broader world holds the same opinions that you do. And that leads to polarization. It also means that we don't have the skills that we need in order to disagree anymore. I mean, it takes real skills and practice to learn how to have a conversation with someone who disagrees with you without arguing. And so when you don't do that, when you don't talk to people who disagree, you start, those skills start eroding. And again, you see this around us, is that we're not good at having those conversations anymore, and so we don't have them.
One suggestion, one practical suggestion you give in the book is to find common ground with that person, which sounds like kind of a fuzzy topic, but I love you give a really specific example. You met someone from a very different perspective than your own, and as I recall, you bet a dollar. Can you tell us what that bet was and why you made it?
Yeah, this is somebody I met while I was traveling, and I happened to be traveling to Arkansas, and it was very clear that we were not going to agree on a lot. And so finally, I just said, hey, I don't think we're going to agree on anything, but I bet you a dollar I can find something we agree on. and it took, I think it took me a couple tries. It was, I think what the first thing we found in common was that we both thought autumn was the best season of the year and that, you know, dogs are better than people, but it's at least something where you can say, okay, here's some safe ground. Let's start talking from this area and treating one another like human beings. And then eventually the conversation kind of evolved. There has to be some trust and some sense of shared humanity.
And it reminds me of another point you make. In addition to finding that common ground, talking to people not as a representative of a category, but as an individual, and presenting yourself in that same way. Can you talk about how to do that?
Yeah, you know, our political parties and the political machines in this country try to make us think that if you're a Democrat, this is what you believe. Boom, 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 boom. You agree with the party line. It's just ridiculous. Voting for one particular candidate doesn't mean you like every Democrat or every Republican. It also doesn't mean you like everything that person does, right? I mean, most of the country is relatively centrist with here and there an opinion that veers off in another direction. So we have to get out of this habit of thinking that political party tells us everything about a person. You know, there was research done that showed that at this point in our history, we are more likely to make assumptions about somebody else based on their political party than their race. And in a country where race and racism are so entrenched and ever present, that's pretty shocking.
I want to point toward a couple different objections that people might have to having conversations about race with people they disagree with in the first place. And one thing you see kind of in the public sector, largely from, I think, white people, is I'm worried that people are going to think I'm racist or call me racist in this conversation. How do you try to overcome that objection, that concern?
So the first thing is I want everyone to stop thinking of racist as the worst thing that can be said about you. And the reason that it is not the worst thing is that, you know, spoiler alert, yeah, you're racist. If racism means that you make assumptions about people based on their perceived race, then yes, you do that. I do that. We all do that. That is a basic bias that human beings have. And so, number one, it's not something to be afraid of. It's just true. The second thing is I try to encourage people in much the same way that historian Ibram Kendi and Isabel Wilkinson have suggested in just not, don't feel the need to call somebody that. The word has just kind of been sapped of all its meaning and power at this point because it's so overused, it's so much used in the wrong context, it's so misunderstood that it just doesn't mean, its meaning is determined by whomever is either saying it or hearing it. So there's, you know, saying to someone, you're a racist, isn't necessarily the best or most productive thing you can do.
And then I've heard objections from Black people who might say, why do I want to enter into a conversation with a person who thinks I'm inferior to them? What would you talk to them about that concern?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why a person of color wouldn't want to enter this conversation, and that is one of them. Mm-hmm. And certainly if someone is saying things to you that demean you, that belittle you, or in any way, shape, or form make you feel that you are less than human, walk away. Don't continue that conversation. It's not the most common conversation you're going to have about race, because the most common conversation about racism that most of us will have is about casual racism and unconscious bias rather than hostile and overt racism. But, yeah, if you're in that kind of conversation, I don't suggest that you continue. A conversation requires mutual respect. Doesn't mean you have to like the person, but you have to respect them. And if you don't have that, then there's no point.
Let me take you to maybe something somebody encountered over the weekend. You're at the Thanksgiving table or whatever the holiday table is next time around, and somebody makes a comment that doesn't sit right, that does seem like it's going into that racist territory. How do you approach that?
So the first thing I would say is please approach it. Like I said, racism, if we're going to confront it in other people, it's going to happen incrementally and it's going to happen over time. So even if all you can stand is a few minutes when they say that racist comment or that microaggression, if all you can bear to do is say that's inappropriate, I see it differently, I'd prefer you not say that thing, and here's why. If that's all you can bear to do, I'd ask that you do it. First of all, the more that people do that, the less likely it is that people will feel those kind of comments are socially acceptable. So it makes it less likely they will make them again. Believe me, it does. But also, it's important that we never allow those kind of comments to stand. We can't allow that to be the social norm. I mean, there's really good evidence, at least in the sexist variety, that we know that if somebody makes a sexist joke and nobody objects, the chances that someone else will make a similar type of joke go up, and they go up by a lot. So we need to make sure that every single time somebody makes a comment like that, it is confronted. Even briefly, even 90 seconds, just make sure you confront it.
And then how?
So I often tell people to use the STAR system, which is stop, tell, assist, restore. So essentially, stop just means literally what it says. Interrupt what they're saying. Try to interrupt them so quickly that you don't let them get to the end of the sentence. And you don't have to say anything brilliant. You just go, wait, what? Or what did you say? Or whoa, whatever it is that you choose, interrupt it. Then you're going to tell them. And all you're doing is saying, I don't agree with that. Rather than saying they're wrong, you're basically saying, I don't think you're right. It's a small distinction, but it's important. Like, I don't see things that way. I see that as inappropriate. Then you're going to assist them by explaining why you have a different perspective. And in this particular case, I need you to own it for yourself. Don't say, would you say that if black people were here? Don't say that's offensive to Asian American people. Own it for yourself. Say, I don't like hearing that kind of thing. It bothers me to hear you say things like that for yourself. And then finally, restore, which is you're going to restore the humanity. And this goes back to trying to make it more likely that they'll be willing to have this conversation again. You're essentially going to say, listen, I know you to be someone who wants to be fair-minded and inclusive, and this doesn't match with the kind of person that I know you are. Something like that.
We're getting advice on how to have productive conversations about race and racism. Celeste Headlee is with us, author of the new book, Speaking of Race, Why Everybody Needs to Talk About Racism and How to Do It. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have trouble with heavy, difficult conversations? What parts are difficult for you? Do you have a success story to share maybe in having these kind of conversations? Or would you like some advice from our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Celeste Headlee. She wrote a new book, Speaking of Race, Why Everybody Needs to Talk About Racism and How to Do It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. John joins us now in Neenah. John, hello.
Hello, sir.
What did you want to bring up, John?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment. I had a thought about racism, and my comment is a definition I have of a racist. Is that there's someone who I believe is not comfortable in their own skin.
Mm-hmm. And that you think that's the motivation, John, in some ways for racism?
Well, we each share the same consciousness, but we interpret it differently. And racism implies that we're invading someone else's space in the sense that we share all the same space. Metaphorically speaking.
I gotcha. John, thanks for the call. What do you think, Celeste, about, I guess, the motivations, the underlying reasons that we might behave in racist ways?
So that is something I don't get into because I'm not qualified to talk about people's motivations.
Sure.
I mean, I will say this. Racism is everywhere. It's when we say it's systemic, it means it's embedded in not just our government, not just our schools, but in our media, in our books, our movies. And so it is no surprise that so many people harbor racist beliefs. Of course they do. It's the air we're breathing.
Thanks for the call, John, at 800-642-1234. Celeste, we talked just a few moments ago about what to do if someone else makes a comment that you find troublesome. You also write about, what if it's me? And you point out cases you admit in your own life, you've done it a couple times. What happens if we're the person who's said something that isn't quite right about race?
Yeah, I've done it a lot more than a couple times. And I'm about as diverse as a person can get, you know. The thing is that even somebody like me, who's Black and Jewish and a very small part Native American, all the other things, there's plenty of cultures I'm neither a member of nor understand. And so, of course, I'm going to make a mistake. I think the first line of that chapter is, there are two types of people, those who have said the wrong thing about race and those who will. So we need to foster a culture of correction in which it's okay. It's not just okay when somebody makes a mistake. We expect it. I'm not talking about overt hostile racism. That I don't really have much time for. But I'm talking about the microaggressions, the slip-ups, that we can be patient with. We don't let them go. We confront them, but we don't imply in any way that having made that mistake makes that person racist and irredeemable and awful.
Talking to Celeste Headlee about her new book, Speaking of Race, Why Everybody Needs to Talk About Racism and How to Do It. Celeste, I know in past books you've written about having difficult conversations about any topic, including race. And you mentioned earlier that a lot of us don't have the tools to have these kind of conversations. What can we do to, I guess, train up before we have to have a tough conversation about race with someone?
Obviously, you know, buy the book. But the point of the book is that I don't want you to spend too much time preparing. I mean, do your homework, of course. Don't use if you're a white person, don't use a person of color as your Google search. But go out and have the conversation and be honest about it. Go to your friend who is Hindu and say, look, I got to be honest with you. I don't know very much. I read this about your faith. Is it okay if I ask some questions? Is it okay if you tell me a little bit more? Tell me about this particular festival. Tell me about the food you eat. What was the weather like in the place where you grew up, et cetera, et cetera. Go approach these conversations with an honest sense of curiosity, and you will be okay.
And you give advice on how to ask a question, which I love as somebody who asks questions for a living. What separates a bad question in this kind of context from a good question?
Oh, bad questions are everywhere. bad questions are, number one, they could be in bad faith. They could be rhetorical, that you're using your question to either shame the other person or lead them to a particular point of view, right? Where were you last night? Why would you think that's okay? Right? Those are not good faith questions. But a good question is one that is open-ended. It's usually brief, and it usually has to be answered with something more than just a yes or no, right? You're inviting the other person to respond in whatever way they like, out of curiosity. That's a good question.
These issues have obviously been a part of American culture since before there was a United States. Do you see progress? Are we getting better at talking about race?
I have no idea. I mean, I can give you my experience based on the past 40 years, and I don't think we've improved all that much. I think we've gotten marginally better. You know, when I was a kid growing up in the 70s and 80s, it wasn't considered polite to talk about race in so, you know, polite company. That's not true anymore for the most part, and that's progress. But it's, you know, we don't have the data. I mean, what is a good conversation about race and how do we track it? I mean, I think that the way we know that we're not having good conversations about race is that we're not really making progress. If we were having truly impactful and productive conversations about race, we would be making more progress.
Can you give us a minute or so of encouragement for people listening to overcome their hesitation about talking about race and give it a shot?
Yeah. So here's the first thing is that we've tried not talking about it, and that's how we're here, right? Like, that clearly hasn't worked. Can we all just be honest about that? The other one is that although the stakes are super high when it comes to fighting systemic racism, the stakes are low for your conversation. You're not going to conquer systemic racism in your 5-minute chat with your neighbor. All you have to do is create some kind of empathic connection. That's it. And that empathic connection can be over an issue of race. It could be over, you know, your favorite kind of flower. But as long as we, with those we disagree especially, as long as we can keep these conversations going that prevent us from seeing those who disagree as other and as somewhat less than human or as enemies, that's still progress. So just give it a go. 90 seconds, 3 minutes, that's all it has to be.
Celeste, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Celeste Headlee is a journalist, speaker, and author of a number of books, including her latest, the one we've been talking about. It's called Speaking of Race, Why Everybody Needs to Talk About Racism and How to Do It. Talk to Celeste about having conversations with people in your life about issues related to race and racism. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, it's this week's edition of Ask a Contractor. From bed bugs to mice, find out how to deal with a wide variety of household pets and prevent them from moving in the first place. Get expert advice and join in with your own questions or maybe your experiences. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. I checked out a couple few books from the library over the weekend, and I returned another one just in time to keep it from being overdue. Now, that's one way to do things. Another way is to wait to return that library book for over 100 years. As reported by KTVB in Boise, Idaho, the local library there got a book returned anonymously. It was a sequel to the book Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm called New Chronicles of Rebecca. Although this book wasn't so new. Didn't have the usual tracking info or barcode on it. It did have that checkout slip inside. Said the last checkout date for the book was in the year 1910. The book was still in good condition. It now lives in a historical room at the Boise Library where you can read it, but you can't check it out. Printed in the book, the line, books may be kept 2 weeks without renewal unless otherwise labeled. A fine of 2 cents a day is imposed on overdue books. Guess whoever checked it out skipped over that part. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk with a reporter behind a massive investigative project at USA Today looking at how police departments around the country retaliate against whistleblowers. Now, after a year and nine-ish months of pandemic, those who work from home may have gotten a bit more casual when it comes to fashion choices. There's the classic nice shirt plus sweatpants combo, the fuzzy blanket that's become a full outfit, and of course, t-shirts, lots and lots of t-shirts. That got us to thinking about our favorite t-shirts, the ones we've been wearing for years, the ones we wear just because they make us laugh, the ones we got from someone we love. Now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite t-shirt of all time that you have owned, past or present? Why do you love it? Is it hilarious? Does it have a sentimental attachment for you? And what is the backstory? Let us know now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. It's all started with an idea from Central Time producer Colleen Leahy, who shares this story to help us get started.
I have a lot of favorite t-shirts, but the one that came to mind immediately is this black t-shirt with a skull and crossbones on it. And the skull has the number 13 on it, and there's a snake like winding through its eyes. And over the top of the skull, it says felon. And I love this shirt because it came from a favorite teacher's garage sale, and she was like kind of goth, and I thought she was really cool. And she told me she got the shirt at the little boy section at Target, and it looks like it. It makes me really happy because it's so absurd.
That's Colleen's t-shirt story. What is yours? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite t-shirt now or in the past, tell us about it, what it means to you, why it's funny. That's 800-642-1234. I'm kind of a practical t-shirt guy myself. But you can surprise me with your shirt at 800-642-1234. We asked around here at Wisconsin Public Media. Ezra Wall, our Southwest Regional Manager, says, I have a faded t-shirt that features three microphones with wrapped cables and quarter-inch plugs that make a peace sign. It's the most comfortable shirt, Ezra says, I've ever owned. After 15 years, I can no longer wear it in public. But it's still a Saturday morning favorite. My 11-year-old niece is dumbfounded when I tell her the shirt used to be black. It is now gray. Sarah Hopeful, on the other side of the glass there, says, my UW-Milwaukee t-shirt with Annabelle the Muppet playing the drums on it. Its color has faded and it's a bit stained, but my mom gave it to my grandpa when she was younger, and I'm very happy to have it now. My other favorite t-shirt is a ridiculous white shirt with an alien on it smoking a cigarette with, but is it art, written at the bottom. Sarah says, it's so stupid, I love it. How about you? We're taking your calls. If you have a favorite t-shirt, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And let us know the story behind that t-shirt. We heard from a caller in Scandia. Mark says he saw a t-shirt in The New Yorker, one of their cartoons, a shirt that said, I wear this shirt, therefore I am. Do you have a zany t-shirt like that? You can also prove me wrong, because I thought, are people really going to call about their favorite t-shirts? And the producers had to persuade me. So you can prove Rob Ferret wrong right now at 800-642-1234 with your t-shirt story. That's 800-642-1234. Hey, people here at WPR have a lot of t-shirt stories. Bill Martins, producer here on Central Time, says his favorite is from an ice cream shop in Door County called Grumpy's. The logo is an angry-looking ice cream cone holding a root beer float and a thing of popcorn. It's kind of funny. People seem to get a kick out of it. I always get comments when I have it on. It's soft. It fits well. And takes me back to Door County. Bill says I get excited whenever I do laundry away because it means I've, or whenever I put laundry away, because it means I've got it ready to wear again. All right, now you're calling. Deb is with us in Cross Plains. Deb, hi.
Hi. Yes, I have a favorite t-shirt. Actually, I have two. The first one was made after my brother passed away. Mm. He was known as Hell Bent. And we had a Freebird on it, like Freebird Lynyrd Skynyrd song.
Sure. Freebird, like that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you bet. And then the other one we made when my friends and I were later in high school, and we were just kind of the knockoff girls. We weren't popular, but we had a great little group. We're still friends, and we came up with our name of Choice Bunch. So we
Choice
had t-shirts
Bunch.
Made, Choice Bunch, and we proudly wore them when my girlfriend was at Ames, Iowa College.
Okay.
We wore them all over campus. So.
Now, did you only wear them when you get together, or would you wear that separately, too?
We wore them separately, too.
Excellent.
But,
Deb,
yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. We'll go now to Don in La Crosse. Don, hi.
Hi. I had a gray shirt with a mosquito pictured over the most of the shirt with it saying, it's time to eat Minnesota.
I love it. So it did. That's the mosquito that ate Minnesota, or one of many, I guess, Don.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much for sharing that. I love it. 800-642-1234. Call in with your favorite t-shirt. Jerry is with us next in Glendale. Jerry, hi.
Oh, hi. I've got two favorite t-shirts. The first one is, I call it my definition of love. you see two cats. You're looking at them from the back. There's a nice moon overhead. And one cat says to the other, if I had two dead rats, I'd give you one.
Aww.
And the other T-shirt was given to me at my bachelor party many years ago. It's the Michelangelo creation of Adam, you know, where there are heavenly figures about to touch fingers.
Right,
where
from
God
the Vatican,
about...
sure.
That's right. And the wording on this one is, pull my finger.
Okay. I was worried a bachelor party wasn't going to be clean, but that's good-natured fun. I love it. Thank you so much for sharing those with us, Jerry. I love it. We are taking your favorite T-shirts, past or present. Mary joins us next in Chippewa Falls. Mary, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your T-shirt, Mary?
Okay, so it's a T-shirt that's the College of William and Mary, and I call it my party shirt. And the reason is my husband's name is William and mine is Mary, so that way I will remember who I came with and who I am.
That's so you go to some pretty rough parties there if you're forgetting by the end of the night, Mary.
Oh, my goodness sakes. We had a great time when we were in Virginia Beach. So, yeah. It was a great party.
I love it, Mary. That's a great story. Katie joins us next in Eau Claire. Katie, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your T-shirt, Katie?
My T-shirt is a saying from The Onion. It was passed down from my sister's best friend to my sister and then to me in high school, and it just simply says, you are dumb. And I have had it for 25-plus years.
Do you still wear it? I mean, this has been a double hand-me-down plus 25 years. Do you still wear it?
I mean, it's not pretty, but yes, it does get used quite often.
I love it. The Onion's original motto. I think they translated it into Latin later. Time for another caller or two. Nancy is with us in Grafton. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. My Wisconsin license plate said 14 kids because we did have 14 children.
Uh-huh.
And so I had a T-shirt that had, like, my license plate on it. And I think that was pretty neat.
That is pretty cool. Did you make that yourself? Or I'm guessing that would be a great gift for a grandma.
No, I had it made by a company here that in town that made those T-shirts. And I had, 14 kids.
Love it, Nancy. I will take one more caller. Tim is with us in Delavan. Tim, hi.
Hi. I got this shirt for my brother. It just says hello on it, and it has two dogs on it. And one is snipping the other's butt.
And that's a hit at parties, I bet.
That, oh yeah, it's the best T-shirt I have ever found. People, they just die laughing when they see it.
I love it. Tim, thank you so much. Thanks to everyone who called in. You can keep sharing your T-shirt stories. Email ideas@WPR.org. We could share some more of them in the future. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Live. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the Macy's of the North.
A thrift shop in Wisconsin's Northwoods is a stark contrast to the Black Friday scene. Jane Hampton takes us to the store in Minocqua, where deals on clothing, cabin decor, and all kinds of stuff draw bargain hunters from far and wide.
Minocqua is a tourist town, but the cute little gift stores are blocks away from the St. Matthias Thrift Shop. It's a plain brick rectangle that used to be a public service building. On a drizzly morning, dozens of shoppers are lined up before doors open at 10. Why are you waiting in line in the rain?
Because it's totally worth it.
What's a lucky find?
My best lucky find was a set of dishes. They were like brand new, sold for $100. I got them for $12.
I'm looking for shoes that fit, and socks.
Finally, the store manager, Jan Degner, unlocks the door.
Are you ready?
Yes!
All right, be nice to each other and have a good time.
Okay.
Degner's a little nervous about this day. It's the big dollar-a-bag event when shoppers pay a buck for whatever they can jam into a brown paper grocery bag. The shop gets chaotic.
I'm very particular about how it looks out on the floor so that it doesn't look junky, so that things look well arranged like a regular store. Some people call it the Macy's of the North.
The Macy's of the North definitely has a woodsy vibe. Degner's husband, Gene, runs the furniture side of things.
If it's a upholstered chair and it has animals on it like deer and bear, they love that.
Loons, deer heads. Those and fish mounds are very popular. I think people like to put them up and say they caught them.
Today, though, the hot sellers are dishes, clothing, and toys.
Like, I love to thrift shop.
it's thrilling, to be honest.
Winona Careful of Lac de Flambeau has four girls under eight, and the St. Matthias Thrift Shop helps with the budget.
My daughters all have birthdays within about a month of each other, too, so it's a tough time of year.
There's nobody in this neck of the woods that should not have boots, not have a coat, not have furniture.
Barbara Dirksen is one of dozens of local volunteers. She and Degner sift through mountains of donations, everything from junk to gems.
One of our volunteers was going through a bunch of socks that came in, opened up one of the socks, and there was a diamond ring in it. You'll find some that have engraving inside, happy anniversary, and those kind of things. Those are sad. There's many a time we've stood out there in the back room and teared up with family members and hugged, and, you know, there's a lot of personal things going on, too.
What happens is when people sell their cottages, they sell it with all the stuff in it because they don't want it. They don't want to take it home to Chicago. They don't want it. And so now new people buy that house. They don't want that stuff, and it used to go in the dump, and it comes here, and it's perfectly good stuff. They just don't want it. It's not their stuff.
It's a cliche. One person's trash is another one's treasure, but it adds up to big bucks at the thrift shop.
Last year, we gave away $470,000.
The shop gives 10% to the church for outreach and 90% to the community. Dozens of local organizations got grants last year, and yes, they totaled nearly $500,000.
I found it was like a glass goose, and it looked pretty cool.
Are there some clothes in that bag for you?
Yes, a lot.
The thrift store is open all winter, along with a special Christmas shop for the holiday season.
Thank you.
Bye. Jane Hampton teaches journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and brought us that story on the St. Matthias Thrift Shop in Minocqua. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a new report found hundreds of examples over the last 10 years of police departments in multiple states trying to silence, discredit, or punish officers who call out corruption and violence in their departments. We'll hear from a reporter involved with the project. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. In the trial of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in spring of this year, some of his fellow officers testified against him. Ultimately, he was convicted of murdering George Floyd. The fact that they didn't stand in support of him runs counter to the notion of a so-called blue wall of silence, that there's an unwritten code that police department colleagues don't turn each other in. But a new project from USA Today suggests that in many departments that wall still exists and that whistleblowers face more consequences than officers who commit crimes or violate policies. Brett Murphy is an investigative reporter for USA Today. He was part of the effort. Brett, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks a lot, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of this reporting project looking into police departments and whistleblowers?
Nationwide. So we were looking at departments large and small across the country and in virtually every state. We filed records requests and did some reporting pretty much everywhere. The goal was breadth and depth, and it took us about a year, three reporters on it full time. So quite a devotion of resources. And we actually started looking into it shortly after the Chauvin case. I was glad you mentioned that. Immediately after that incident, the fellow officers there, their statements justified his use of force. It was only after the video came out, you know, the outcry, the protests, and then the ultimate criminal charges that the department, did not stand by him any longer. So we were curious from the beginning, just how common that phenomenon was, what sort of the mechanisms were that departments used. And that's really what got us going was that case there in Minneapolis.
When police officers do reveal wrongdoing from among their fellow officers, what are some of the most common responses they get from colleagues and departments?
Well, from colleagues, we found in our interviews and records from colleagues, the reaction is swift. Once they find out very often that one of their own had reported against them or testified against them, it's sort of the typical alienation, ostracization type of stuff. Immediately, those whistleblowers can feel kind of the sidelong glances. And sort of the, you know, the more egregious cases we found, you know, they would get the dead locker or the dead rats in the lockers, the death threats, that sort of stuff. And they would start to fear for their own safety quite a bit. Those were the extreme cases. The departments themselves, it was a little more formal kind of mechanisms used. Most often we found it was internal affairs would get turned against those officers. They would open up investigations into them for smaller trivial infractions, sometimes going deep into that officer's history to kind of build a case against them. The officers we talked to said that this was, you know, sort of a concerted effort to discredit them and discredit the misconduct that they brought forward, discredit them as witnesses. So that was a pretty common tactic we saw.
Can you talk about one of the stories you, I believe, reported on one of them in Los Angeles, an officer reporting what appear to be egregious, basically a gang internal to the police department. Can you share a little bit about that story for us?
Yeah, that's one of the larger scandals that we included in this story. Others have reported on it as well. That's the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. There was an officer there, or a deputy there, rather, Art Gonzalez, who exposed a gang of deputies who called themselves the Executioners. It's roiled into a pretty large scandal now. But he, you know, kind of like what I was saying earlier, shortly after Gonzalez came forward, you know, there was pictures of graffiti. You know, Art is a rat on it. There's a dead rat. All that sort of stuff. Then shortly after, he said the supervisors forced him to resign from his position as a training officer. He got his pay cut. So that's sort of the stuff we find pretty often, is that, you know, the system comes down on them. And if there's a union, like in the case of Gonzalez, you know, they might abandon the guy or discourage him from moving forward with his complaint. That was part of what we found in Gonzalez's case as well. So that one was, you know, it was a good example of what we found in a lot of places where in any sort of systemic or widespread misconduct was being exposed.
You and your colleagues talked to some experts about possible solutions to make it to increase accountability and to protect whistleblowers. What were some of the suggestions you heard?
Well, there was we're going to get into this a little more in a story we have coming in the series. But what we found kind of time and again that, you know, there weren't a lot of protections for police whistleblowers. There's very specific and prescriptive reporting avenues that they have. And a lot of those are internal. You know, you have to go up the chain of command. If you go outside of the chain of command, a lot of those complaints or grievances get funneled right back. So a lot of the experts we talked to suggested, you know, kind of devoted reporting avenues, you know, whistleblower hotlines for these people, that they were guaranteed safety if they were to use. Likewise, you know, the legal protections we found in several states are pretty weak or in some cases non-existent. And if you are an officer looking for, you know, legal protection, the bar is very high. They don't have the same federal First Amendment protections that a lot of others do. So a lot of the experts we talked to discussed, you know, possible legal frameworks that would protect these guys as well. So there were some options out there, you know, we found that could help sort of make it easier for someone looking to report misconduct in the department.
And just our last minute, are there departments around the country that have done better on this?
Yeah, for sure. The cases we found were not in literally every department. There were some that, they received the whistleblower's complaint and then they took action against an officer who was accused of the misconduct. They congratulated or promoted. the whistleblower who came forward. So we did find a couple examples of that. At Del City, Oklahoma, there was a department in New Jersey as well. So, you know, while it was widespread, our reporting did not suggest that it was entirely ubiquitous. However, on the same token, we found hundreds of cases of retaliation, but there's likely a lot more out there. The system we found and the officers we talked to said it all has a chilling effect. You know, it works. If there is someone who's made an example of inside of a department, that can discourage others from coming forward.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Brett Murphy, investigative reporter for USA Today, about a series on police whistleblowers and retaliation against them. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get advice on making the best use of our time and time blocking. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then pets have become a much bigger deal in the U.S. over the last few decades, and society hasn't always kept up. The author of the new book, Pet Nation, tells us about the reign of cats and dogs. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.